Welcome to...
It's not a rant! It's an...
Articulate Warbling. Hosted by Zach Ferguson. Edited and produced at Badger's Drift Studio. If you enjoyed this podcast, please contact us at pgttcm.com so we can make more. And let us know. We would love to make more of this show for you. And here he is, Zach Ferguson.
Good morning, good afternoon, or whatever time that you find yourself listening to this warble. I'm Zach Ferguson, and today will be included a special, extremely warble mania topic and subject and vignette concerning Sonic the Hedgehog. The recent release, the recent redesign, it was something that just, you know, I'm not a gamer, but I, like everyone else, know the iconography, the connotations, the overall iconographic effect and almost histrionic prevalence and sincerity. And, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog, along with Donkey Kong, along with all these other Sega games, we all have a connective tissue with it, whether we're big gamers, half-hearted gamers, or that one weekend out of the millions that have come before where you've gone to an arcade game and spent the majority of the time playing Sega games. I grew up not playing Sonic, but watching Sonic, and I just had a really strong reaction upon the first trailer and the mess that it was, and not just considering the design of Sonic and the, disingenuous attempt to make something new with Sonic. Give us Sonic as Sonic. So here in episode 8 will be included my 10-minute rant and ramble. It's not a rant, it's articulate warbling. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to It's Not a Rant, It's Articulate Warbling with me, the warbler, Zach Ferguson. Now, this is a very, very special episode. It's like one of my most reactionary episodes, and I think that's quite, you know, apt. You know, that's where the great warble has come from. Now, Sonic the Hedgehog, the redesign. It's a rarity that producers and visual effects teams react or take into account what the fan base does. Usually they have some rhetoric. The producer heads ultimately decide to release the movie, piss the fans off, and then do some alterations to a sequel, much like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle series produced by Michael Bay, another Paramount Pictures film. But upon the release of Sonic the Hedgehog's trailer about 3, 4, 5, 6 months ago, it was a travesty. It not only did the film look shit, it just didn't capture the tone. With Jim Carrey, that kookiness and that almost animated sense of, you know, it's juxtaposed to just, you know, it just didn't go. The slapstick comedy with that ultra-serious tone of Sonic the Hedgehog with the Gangster's Paradise thing. It was like, we're doing a realistic, grounded world of Sonic the Hedgehog. You can't do Sonic the Hedgehog grounded or realistically. And the design was a travesty and unevenly. The tone was awful. The trailer was awfully cut. And the design did not live up to it. And it's a rarity that a studio says, okay, we're taking this into account. Even the director said, okay, we've listened. We're going to redesign it. And not only have they redesigned Sonic, this trailer is cut to perfection. It really gives the sense and playfulness of a great family adventure movie. A lot of people have parred it up for something of the caliber that Detective Pikachu does. Yes, take a leaf out of that book because it worked. Sonic looks like Sonic, which is really good. It's a Sonic movie, so he should look like it. And also, now the performance of Jim Carrey, it's just it seamlessly melds together. It's perfect. That trailer was a terribly cut trailer, and the design wasn't the greatest issue. Okay, it was in the broader picture. But due to the backlash, they reacted. And instead of sending out a press release and rhetoric or doing some change-ups, they've given us a trailer that really personifies a Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Again, they've leaned in onto that reality of a CGI, well-renowned character leaning in on a human relationship. We've seen that one and done. I'm really annoyed that they can't just go out and make a Sonic the Hedgehog movie centered on Sonic. Why do we need to lean onto that human familiarity? We're in an age where people are accepting of watching animated movies or animated movies with live action elements. And why do we need that resonance of a human connectivity or relationship or duality or friendship? They don't need to lean on that. Just let them be the focus. But James Marsden, he's got the funnies. He's worked in a lot of movies like this against CGI characters, like 2011's Hop. But this looks different because it captures the tone and, you know, the edge and aesthetic. And a lot of people had complained about the original trailer saying it feels odd. Jim Carrey is just trying too hard. Jim Carrey doesn't need to try too hard, but it's very good to see the very early 90s, early noughties version of Jim Carrey. A lot of the time recently, he's really been doing serious performances, and even in his comedic work, it's like I need to really par down the elasticity of my face and the almost rubber band quality of my body. And here it's just Jim Carrey being Jim Carrey and loving it and giving to us as an audience what we love seeing from Jim Carrey and have sorely missed. Though I do love his more, you know, less spastic, wendy bendy slapstick performances. Like his, you know, a lot of great comedians, comedic actors are great at, you know, dramas or real performances in quotation marks. But there's a lot of resonance and a lot of, I think, depth that goes into a comedic role. So it's really good. And it's very fitting with the style. And the trailer is good. And I expected them releasing a trailer beat for beat of what came before, but with just a whole redesign. I thought they weren't going to do an overhaul, but you can tell that they've shifted it editorially. They're saying, okay, let's focus in on that Sega Sonic aesthetic. Because overall, I think from that trailer, maybe it was just a badly put together trailer, and with the awful addition of there not being a truthful design to Sonic, who is this icon. Like, I love Sonic the Hedgehog, not on a gaming perspective, but I was introduced to the cartoons. I have played Sonic before. I know that world. But it just felt like a hodgepodge of things, and it was just going to be a mess. Maybe it wasn't going to be. Maybe it always had that comic sensibilities. It just wasn't captured as right. They maybe were veering for doing a real Sonic, realistic, hard, grippy thing. Most, or at the end of the day, it was stylistically slapstick comedy, big, bold family entertainment. But the first trailer didn't really exude that. But this one does. I think they've reshot a lot. They've executed a lot of other animated sequences that really personify the Sonic we know and love. And the design is beautiful, and also the world of Sonic, and it's just fun. There's a couple of shots in here that we've seen in the original trailer, but just by the redesign, it adds something else. It adds a flavor. There's not something dislocating or disjointed about it, and I really enjoyed this. I'm so fucking excited for it. Yes, it will probably be a 3-star subpar family film, but those moments of Sonic, you know, with his speed force and him coming head to head with Dr. Robotnik's, you know, plethora of technologies. I just think this looks like a superb family film. And I am so, so thankful that the producers, the studio, the visual effects team, specifically the visual effects team, Tim Miller's team, his animation studio, for going, you know what, we're going in there, and not only are we going to redesign it, we're going to recraft it, do new segments. And also on the director, who I feel has gone out, reshot a few things, and has really evened it out, taken away that super serious thing that was trying to be personified for the use of music and through the edit and the trailer. They're trying to offer us something that we didn't ask for. We just want a good Sonic the Hedgehog movie, and that's kind of what I feel that we are going to get now. And I don't think it's just a redesign thing. I think it was an overhaul thing. So a huge, big double thumbs up for the visual effects team and for the creative team and the writers team and the actors and especially the director, who reacted himself and said, okay, we get it, we understand it, we are going to redesign it. But I don't think it was just a redesign on the aesthetical structure of Sonic, but I think the world and also the tempo of the world. I'm not going to say that the slapstick aesthetics and vignettes and humour and DNA wasn't in there, but I think it was a really bad hodgepodge of tones that wasn't really truthfully personified in the first trailer or captured. But this one is just different. It is the Sonic the Hedgehog movie we want. That poster's amazing. And they've reacted in a positive manner. Whereas a lot of the times when producers and heads react to overall fans' reactions, not subjected on a first release of a movie, but usually from what becomes something, if it's part of a franchise that's come before, and they're like, oh, we didn't like that tone, and they're like, okay, let's go in and cut it to death like they did with Suicide Squad, and a lot of DC, and specifically Warner Brothers, has done with their works. But Paramount others have done this. I've shaped it up and tried to give you something different, like with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, which I think is a very good film in of itself. But again, they overhauled the design and didn't really feel confident with what they had from before because it was such backlash to it. I love Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the 2014 version, and I love the sequel as much as it's overhauled stylistically and aesthetically. But it's such a rare thing that a team and such a hierarchical thing that they said, okay, let's put a break in this. And I kind of anticipated a almost year postponement, but this was originally meant to be out this November. Now it's pushed to February next year. So the visual effects team have really knocked it out the park for making this film look as visual and gorgeous. And also the team behind it, the second unit directors, because you can tell a lot has been reshuffled, reshot for the betterment of the film, not just for the betterment of fan rhetoric and fan outcry. This comes from a place of we actually are going to listen to the fans and not listen to the supposed fans online crying like big boo-boos. This is actually coming from a place where fans are like, we don't like the look of it, we don't like the feel of it, we're not going to come out to see this. Whereas you get that from every film and every reaction from a trailer, but they actually sat down, they evaluated it, and I think that the studio and the creative team behind it themselves were like, because even before official footage was released, there was like leaks of the design of Sonic, and it was already implemented there, the almost the unnervingness and that almost unpredictable, almost, you know, unfaithful, like, you know, feeling they had in themselves, that they had no confidence in themselves. So when that first trailer came out, it really probably personified what they were doing wrong. And they have gone out their way and they have crafted a beautiful looking movie, beautiful design, and it just captures that Sega mentality. Like the first trailer, we live most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. We hear Sonic the Hedgehog running all around his entire life. This is a badass little hedgehog now, and he's gonna destroy everything now. He's gonna destroy the Speed Force way, and you know he's a gangster paradise way. Oh, but putting Gangster's Paradise anywhere doesn't make you, it doesn't appropriate any stylistic sense. It just unevens and unbalances everything. But what I'm going to say is, they've done it for the betterment, not just because of the outcry, but because I think they overall looked at it and went, shit, we've actually made something that's not good or is very uneven. But I love it. Also, Jim Carrey just looks so badass, and there's so many hilarious beats in here that just makes you smile, and just the whole texture, and, you know, the perfect union. Also, the new segments and sequences that we see based in the world of Sonic and also in real life, like the Wall of China sequence, or when he's in the desert, like, it just looks great. And they've really proven to us that they've listened to fans, not listened to supposed fans or listened to outcry online. They actually listened to the fans, took it into account, and went, we're going to put hold on this. But surprisingly, they haven't postponed it by a year. They've only postponed it by 3 months. 3 months. And considering a lot of people were being quite, you know, pessimistic, going, they're just going to redesign it, they're not going to change anything. And I felt that they were going to release that trailer as a rebuttal, like, fuck you, it's going to be the same style trailer, fuck you, it's just going to have a redesign. But instead, they've released a trailer that truly personifies the movie that they have crafted and recrafted and perfected. Will it be a masterful film? I don't know. But from the looks of this, I am so fucking excited. And all my heart and love and respect goes to the studio, the executive, and the visual effects team who have knocked it out of the fucking park. So Sonic the Hedgehog, I am definitely going to go see that on Valentine's Day next year. Permitting if my girlfriend Laura will come with me. She probably won't. But she will still have to suffer the moaning, groaning, warbling and reaction up on my first viewing of it. So yeah, I just had to throw this out there as like a special segment to include in episode 8, or just as its own isolated short episode, because Sonic the Hedgehog, I'm really confident and happy and willing to book my ticket as soon as possible those tickets are available, because this looks like the Sonic the Hedgehog film that we wanted, the one that we kind of anticipated was going to come from Disney, considering what they were doing and foreshadowing in their Wreck-It Ralph films. I am so glad that they took into account what fans said, not just outcry supported by the amalgamation and the trending and, you know, the polling statistics online of the naysayers. It actually came from a place of understanding and actually being pulled out of themselves and going, shit, we fucked this up. So Sonic the Hedgehog, watch the first trailer, weep, headbutt any surface hard enough to knock you out for a couple of minutes, then reawaken, and it will be abolished. And then you look online and go, oh, Sonic the Hedgehog trailer, deja vu, and you'll watch this one and you'll be like, oh my fucking god, this is amazing. So yeah, that segment is Sonic the Hedgehog Redux. Thank you for listening, and
hey everyone, welcome back. This is me, DB Spitzer, the editor and producer of Articulate Warbling with Zach Ferguson. Just wanted to let you know that we're hoping to make this a full-time series and not just a backdoor pilot. So if you would like to help sponsor the show, or if you have anything that you'd be like wanting to donate to help the show keep going, let us know. PGTTCM.com. And where you can reach Zach is in the show notes, and also where you can buy his many books, Zach Ferguson, and you can check him out, of course, on Amazon.com, where he's got all kinds of wonderful books, from Dimension Horse to What Mr. Wants, Mr. Gets. All right, back to Zach.
It's Articulate Warbling. So, also included will be my review for Doctor Sleep, the official sequel to the Kubrick film, whilst also being the sequel to Kubrick's film, it is a sequel to Stephen King's The Shining. So today's episode will start off with the review of Doctor Sleep. I was so excited. So excited. Doctor Sleep is one of my favourite King novels. Stanley Kubrick's The Shining is one of my favourite Stanley Kubrick films. Whilst not actually being one of my favourite of Stephen King's adaptations, I feel that what Kubrick did was he really picked up The Shining and made it his own thing, and it's lived on as its own thing, separated in a way and disjointed from the novel that Stephen King wrote in the early 70s. Now, Doctor Sleep is directed by a Stephen King adaptation, Illumini, someone who really lives and breathes King, Mike Flanagan, who's a very talented director, who's got a great relationship with Netflix and have given him so much room to create, specifically with his movie Hush, his recent television adaptation and series of The House on Haunted Hill. And giving him a bigger, broader template budget and such a worldwide international audience, though Netflix offers that, it just feels different when a director of this caliber and talent, someone who not only writes, directs and produces and lives and breathes the product and the creative process and the piece of art in question so much and wholly as Mike Flanagan does, this is just feels bigger, and Doctor Sleep is that. Whilst I came out feeling a lot is left to be desired, it's a great film when it's sectoring in on the original, newer, fresher streaks, particularly adapting Doctor Sleep as a novel into a film. Now, you really can't make a sequel to The Shining whilst discounting what Kubrick did before, but I feel that what really makes Kubrick's The Shining film so powerful is its symbology, its many subliminal messages, its overall aesthetic, its look. It is an emblem of its time, it's an emblem of a filmmaker reaching his peak, adding his flavour to what, because this is what Kubrick did. He really saw other filmmakers doing stuff within different genres and he's like, okay, I'm going to try my hand at that. And then he just really pushes it and really steps up the game and pushes boundaries and really, again, exemplifies a certain calibre and quality of horror filmmaking or whatever genre he's working within, like science fiction with 2001 A Space Odyssey, or a transgressive, hard experimental cinema such as A Clockwork Orange, or, you know, almost historical epics like Barry Lyndon. But The Shining is just so omnipotent, it's so vast, it's so dense, though it can easily be misinterpreted as a certain caliber of film, whereas it offers something wholly different. It shows a director at a peak of creative fluctuation and breeding and birthing something. But Doctor Sleep really, I feel, takes something away from Kubrick's Shining. You can't really do a Shining sequel without being beholden to what came before. But I really feel that Stephen King here is like rubbing his hands together, because it is not an unknown thing that Stephen King does not like The Shining, and hence his push to get a shining television series out there that was truthful to his adaptation, which he much prefers. I think King really needs in his life to separate that adaptation from what he did. Your book, The Shining, exists as a Stephen King form and it exists as a Kubrick form. And I feel that what Mike Flanagan does and fails to do his is he really detracts and infuses that supernatural, paranormal aesthetic and design and reason and whole narrative construct into what Kubrick wasn't really doing. Kubrick was doing a very cerebral, subconscious, subliminal, prosaic, mosaic, very dense film that's up for interpretation, but it never was specific to the supernatural, paranormal, supernal, almost, you know, illumined nature that King really felt that Kubrick's lack. Kubrick's film is an entity upon itself, but I feel that the homage or the tribute to what came before in Kubrick's feels less glorified and less playing on that nostalgic beat, and also playing up to that, well, we can't really make Dr. Sleep without paying homage to what came before. And it kind of muddies the water for me. It kind of injects what Kubrick's film was and how resonant and powerful it is. And the sequel really takes something a little bit away from The Shining, given that this is an official sequel. But the film, a lot of ways, feels like an unofficial sequel. And I know there's been a lot of complaint and a lot of back-patting and applauding for Mike Flanagan for deciding not to do CGI recreations, but I just think that would be more truer. Instead, he recasts and has different actors, and there's just this disjointed dislocation. It's striving to be part of The Shining world on the aesthetical level, but there's no connective tissue. And I think just by having the recreations of the original cast of a Jack Nicholson and the rest, but as much and truthfully and wholly as it encapsulates the love and, you know, the aesthetical pleasures that a lot of people garner from The Shining is not horrifying or petrifying, but it's subliminal messages, it's overall almost contemplative intent, it's subconscious way. I think the usage of subconscious psychological, almost Freudian, and juxtaposition of different psychologies and emblematic of iconographic images imprinted upon our mind aesthetically, but also the connotations of what it means to the human nature, human psyche, alcoholism, mental health, self-projection, the projection of mental disintegration onto inanimate objects or foundations that are structures such as the Overlook Hotel. Here it is a very faithful adaptation of Dr. Sleep whilst also losing its bearings and its almost centred power. The power of this adaptation is the new stuff, the stuff where it is living and breathing its own thing. And then with the infusions of those Kubrickian aesthetics, it feels like it's playing on a nostalgic chord, but instead of a punch, it's a slap, and it's a reminder, and it's quite disjointed, and it pulls you out of it a lot of the time. And I know Flanagan strived, but I feel that as a creator, and especially as an adaptator, he is strong when adaptating King directly. And I just don't know how this film could have gone about maybe making it a little bit more truer to the Kubrick nature, but also Dr. Sleep is so much an emblem of what came before, the Shining novel, not the Shining film. It was a follow direct sequel to the novel, not the film. And whereas a lot of familial ties sometimes are quagmired in convoluted perceptions and appreciations and biased notions, I still have this feeling that as truthful and as wholly well-intended as it was, and trying to sidle up Stephen King and the Kubrick vision and kind of putting them together and giving them resonance and almost settling that age-old defined hostility King has, I think King's in the background going, oh, we're bringing Kubrick into my world. We're Kubrick's work and his dense psychologies and use of camera and angles. We've infused that with my overall intent, which was it's supernatural. It's nothing, nothing dense. It's all supernatural. Yes, it's supernatural. We're infusing. It feels like it takes away that something special. It's Dr. Sleep basically sitting on the fence. It's being a love letter to what Kubrick did whilst not actually doing it, where it feels intrusive, whereas it's exemplified the supernatural underpinnings, the telekinesis type world of these people, these people who shine. It's a strong foundation, it's a strong narrative in of itself, Dr. Sleep. But again, how can we find a way around truly doing a sequel to The Shining, the novel and the film at the same time? I think they really should have leaned in a little bit heavier if they wanted it to be a Kubrickified film. Like, there are certain shots and angles that Mike Flanagan tries to recreate, and in his assumption is a Kubrickian setup. It just feels reinforced, almost. It's a contradiction, and it's a conflicting experience. When it's working on the drive and the narrative and the emotive connectivity to the characters and what's come before, specifically with Danny Torrance, played masterfully and very understatedly and subtly by Ewan McGregor. But for as long as this film is 152 to 53 minutes, there's a lacking of something, because it's that intrusivity of, well, we are heralding what came before, 1980s The Shining, whilst also really zoning in, honing in, and homing in on what makes Dr. Sleep powerful, and also its connection to us. And it doesn't feel like it's a connection at all. It just feels like it's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge Easter egg, but an Easter egg that's expanded upon and stretched out far too long. It feels like an unofficial sequel, whereas this has been posited and marketed as an official sequel. It just feels damning to what came before. And I don't know how any of this could be improved upon. I know Mike Flanagan was... it's a typewrite act and a balancing act, but I don't think he really justified his overall inclusion of everything Kubrickian or the iconography of Kubrickian stuff. And it's almost the iconography that's imprinted photographically and the most big mainstays. And I feel there's many more certain moments and things up for deliberation, up for consideration, that could have been extrapolated and used a little bit more thoughtfully and carefully and subtly. Here it's just almost a rerun of the great big hits, those great big moments in The Shining, whereas I think there's many other vignettes and segmentations in The Shining that could have been interweaved masterfully into Mike Flanagan's adaptation of Dr. Sleep, ever so much so then just using those big supposed scares or characters that featured quite prevalently throughout The Shining. Or did they feature that prevalently? I don't think so. They are defined for their small moments and their huge impact with, you know, the iconography of things and the cultural status of things. But I think there's a lot to really nip and tuck when it comes to emotion and to do with character development that could have been really weaved well into this world. And also by including the original actors or some semblance of it, like Blade Runner 2049 did, by recreating characters with CGI, it's capable. And I just thought it would have made it a little bit more connective, emotive. And though every time the story is very focused on the adaptation of Dr. Sleep, when it reverts back to the Kubrickian verse, it feels forced. It feels like it's playing on those nostalgic ties, whilst also trying to, you know, be genuine in its approximation and detail and exposure to, you know, tying things together. But it comes as disingenuous. I think Mike Flanagan works well when he's focusing on the newer material, but when it reverts back to something else, it pulls you out of it, because there's a disconnect, there's a dislocation for me. And I watching this film, when it's centered on the narrative of Dr. Sleep and it doesn't revert back to Kubrick's film in an aesthetical valued fashion, though it does try and tie in narrative streaks and narrative arcs and character de-evolution or evolutions within, let's say, expositional scenes or sequences where we see the torment and the pressure and the sins of our fathers type unraveling and interweaving of the characters, specifically on Danny Torrance, masterfully captured by Ewan McGregor. But there's just seeing something, there's a modernistic cinematic palette that doesn't really cross over well into what Kubrick did before. It's very hard to recreate what came there from that certain time and era. Certain filmmakers can do it, but it just seems like a recreation and almost a hits list of sequences that Mike Flanagan obviously is beholden to, and also what he feels that even if you're tied or seen The Shining before, or have not, or have any familial basis around it, or if you have a relationship with it, or if you don't, or if you just have a veering contemplation, everyone knows the iconographic images, the two twins, Floyd, the axe, everyone knows. You just see that and you know it's The Shining. And I feel that's just worn out a little bit. It's played up too much. I think it's an overt sensorium of emotions, and it just lacks something, and specifically with the recasting of characters not having any resemblance to what came before. And also, though as beautifully as the Overlook is recreated in those sequences, I think what would have been much more truer was use the footage that came before instead of recreating it. I don't know if there's any licensing issues under Warner Brothers and Kubrick and using that footage for his intended or... So in a way, it does feel like an unofficial sequel whilst trying to be genuinely a sequel. It just feels a little bit disingenuous, though wholly well-intended. I just feel it leaves you lacking. And the last 15 minutes, it just falls into the usual CGI bomber form of throwing it at the screen. And it just uglies it up. It seems the aesthetic that Mike Flanagan has, you know, the template he had and he'd been working from when it came to his vision of this new narrative and story we've not seen or heard before, which is Dr. Sleep. And it fell out of grips with what it had come before. It felt rushed, and then it felt really forced, spliced, diced. And as well intended, it's just very distracting. And I know a lot of people have gone out of the way and said, this really feels like it's tied to Kubrick's The Shining. It doesn't. And I think that's just due to the ills of modern technology, the cameras, the edit, just the modern prismata and the DNA. And truthfully, what films are to this day, they have that certain look, that certain caliber. You know a certain film and what era it comes from just by looking at it, not just by costume and performances. As much as you want to recreate a certain era or time, you're just not going to capture it. I think by using the original footage, it might have had that connective tissue, wherein if you use the CGI form of things by recreating characters or de-aging, it would have worked instead of recasting. It feels like a disconnect. It feels like these are Easter eggs and little snippets and little wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but extrapolated and pulled so far that you see the blurred lines of where it just doesn't fucking work. So Dr. Sleep, I have a great issue with, because when it's working on the levels of adapting the book, it's superb. But then the inclusion of the Kubrick verse, why couldn't they have just made Dr. Sleep without having any allusions to what came before? Why don't you just make it your own new holy thing? Because it wants to work on that nostalgic side of things. As popular as The Shining is and Stephen King's relationship, you still can't quantify the reasonings. Yes, you can, and that's Kubrick's genius. Like, King is probably of the belief that why didn't you just do Dark to Sleep, and whilst doing Dark to Sleep, do illusions and reverts back to what came from the book. And then instead, it feels like something a little bit more insidious is happening. Like, by using Kubrick's footage or iconographic images, Mike Flanagan is almost infusing it with that King template and that King aesthetic and that King reasoning that King felt was lacking in The Shining. You can quantify and contemplate that. Okay, we can do a Stanley Kubrick follow-up, but I think it should have been an infused Stanley Kubrick thing. Wind it in, merge it in some more. It feels like it's a plague and it's a virus trying to take something away from the past, while trying to be, you know, not disingenuous but truthful and hopeful and respectful. And it doesn't come across as respectful. It comes across as muddied and conflicted, and it's a balancing act that doesn't work. You're balancing on it, and instead you're just like flat in the middle, hitting yourself in the gonads off that fence. And whilst you're on that fence, the whole fucking fence comes down with you. I thought this film was working much more to its strength when it centred on the evolution of Danny and when it didn't harken back to Kubrick's vision. Because it's so beholden, but also it comes across as lifeless, it comes across as ill-founded, it comes across as deliberate, it comes across as if it's playing up to nostalgic beats, it's playing up to something deliberate, it's trying to be too truthful and respectful whilst losing that resonance of what makes it so special. There's a lot of moments in The Shining that could have been tied beautifully to the narrative streak and arc of Danny Torrance when it came to Dr. Sleep, and from the connective tissue of what Danny went through in The Shining with his father and such and sundry, and other segmentations and sequences. Though there's beautiful motifs and themes and scores that are used masterfully for this, it's wearing in on that nostalgic thing, and nostalgia is wearing thin now because there's a hyper-awareness to it. And that hyper-awareness also gives you a perspective and a broader scope of contemplation that this feels forced, this feels disingenuous, it just doesn't work, and it doesn't work. Aesthetically and connectively, it doesn't feel like it's part of The Shining universe. And then by highlighting, exemplifying it, and keep throwing out these sequences that are so ingrained in your subconscious and your conscious mind when it comes to film and history and culture and its relevance and prevalence, even if you don't know what the fucking Shining is, you still go, oh, that sequence and that shot from The Shining, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, this is a very protracted thing. I just feel like it strived whilst feeling hollow and lacklustre. And I think Mike Flanagan, just the balancing act didn't work for him. It all fell in on itself, and he didn't do his due diligence and respect to what came before, because there's that plaguing of, well, everything in The Shining is supernatural, whereas it's not. It's up for multiple considerations, but Kubrick was very defined in his thing that, I don't truly believe that this place is a supernal environment. There's nothing paranormal. It's all within the minds of our characters. It's all allegory. It's all symbolic. It's all subconscious. Whereas this film just devalues that. Though The Shining will stand as its own thing. It doesn't detract that. But if you want to make a truthful sequel to that movie, whilst also infusing what King did with the book, you need to find a perfect in-between, an impasse where you can work together and mould. And it just felt intrusive, it felt forced, and from when it was working off a direct adaptation of Dr. Sleep, it was its own thing. It was Flanagan being ingenious. Like, Flanagan is writer, director and editor on this movie, and there's a certain sequence when it comes to this cult who sucks out the steam, the shine of certain characters, and this one main character searches her out, and then we see Rose the Hat doing her thing, and it's just beautifully done, sped up, and it's just simplistic editorial skills, but not sheened. But then when it goes back to the traditionalisms of what Kubrick did, it doesn't mar up well. He should have deliberately made the story and the emotive tissue combine better with what came with The Shining and what was there for consideration, instead of playing the hits list or the most populist shots. There was not much ingenuity in its combination. I feel it worked well when it was playing the Dr. Sleep story, but from a 4-star film, the last 20 minutes and those intrusive moments really pulled me out. And I was thinking, is this 2.5? Is this 2? It's just, I'm just not connected. And then there's moments where I was really swelled and pushed, and even some nostalgic bits, specifically with that wah, 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 wah score, where it's expanded upon by the composer and the motifs and the vignettes. But then that nostalgia fizzles out because there's that hyper-awareness. Even that swooping opening shot that Kubrick does is recreated here. But even then, it's forced. Sometimes it feels like it can fizzle in and ingrain with the footage, like two negatives being melted together. But it's just very lackluster. And overall, though entertaining, it doesn't feel assured. It doesn't feel confident. So I have to give Dr. Sleep, sadly, 2 stars. I was veering to 3, but I wouldn't recommend it. It's too long, whilst also lacking. If you want to read and experience a sequel to The Shining book, read Dr. Sleep. In a lot of ways, it can work as a follow-up to Kubrick's film, in as much as you want. Sorry, I apologise about that, but that's a confliction and contradiction of experience, perspective, and all such and sundry. So, yeah, I give it 2 stars. It left me wanting so much, and it just didn't deliver. Ewan McGregor's perfect. Rebecca Ferguson is plaintive. I don't think she's a very talented actress. I think she's very unlikable in every role. And when she does put herself forward, it's lackluster. It's the same steely-gazed hourglass figure woman with busty breasts who's alluring and attractive, and she knows about it, and she just doesn't add much to the story. I feel that this film's strength is when it focused on Ewan McGregor and his relationships in and around this little town that he's found himself put in, but it doesn't. It just veers, and it doesn't balance, and it just doesn't fucking work. It just doesn't. And everyone going, oh, it feels part of the same world. Oh, it's so superb. It isn't, because it's playing on that nostalgic thing, and you're too blind to see that it's doing that thing that seems to be working every fucking where. Like, It Chapter 2 does the nostalgia thing, but it works because it's just genuinely thought out and it's infused. It's not forced. This feels fucking forced with so many things. Like, we're putting nostalgia for the sake of it because we want the emotion to be felt, but we're not doing it we're doing it not disingenuously, we're doing it wholesomely, and it's like a delusional thing. Like, as much as we're saying it on repeat, it's not making it true, and it just makes it highlighted and exemplified as a disingenuous mockery that it is. Dr. Sleep, just piss me off. Utterly and totally. It's a very contradictory, conflicting feeling I have. And I left the cinema and did at least a 9-10 minute rant. And I was going to include it as a thing to juxtapose how an initial reaction to a film can change just overnight or a day or two. But the footage and the recording was just so crap with the cars in the background and interruptions. But just by one sleep, it's just grown on me that this film does not work. It works when it's adaptating Dr. Sleep. It does not work when it tries to do something with Kubrick that just feels disingenuous, forced, and just shallow, in as much as they are well-intended, specifically Mike Flanagan and co. So, that's it for It's Not a Rant, It's Articulate Warbling with me, Zach Ferguson. Big thanks to DB Spitzer, producer extraordinaire, who's still busy pushing out new podcasts. And look out for them. Please hit subscribe if you want to review and let me know how awful I am or how good I am or how just, you know, earache inducing I am. Please do. Look out for my books on Amazon, Dimension Horse, Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe, What Mr. Wants, Mr. Gets. And I hope to hear back from you soon. And I want to also reach out. If anyone has any novels who are indie artists or even, you know, a publisher, and they would be interested in hearing an honest review from myself, please send it along to the It's Not a Rant, It's Articulate Warbling Facebook page, and we'll see what we can do. I don't expect physical copies, as a writer who sent out so many physical copies of novels, proof copies of such and sundry, and no one reviews them. Just send along a PDF and tell me what you expect. Not, I will review your book truthfully. If you're like, please review my book but be nice, I'd be like, fuck off. But anyway, going on and on and on, the 8th episode was intended to be a 1-hour special for Tom Six's The Human Centipede full sequence film series, but having seen Dr. Sleep and what happened with Sonic the Hedgehog trying to get released and these things were bubbling up, I thought instead of forcing myself to do something in the moment to hit a criteria, I thought just do a review that really personifies what the podcast is, a man warbling and reactionatorially, that's not a word but I've created it, reacting to something and critiquing something and talking about something in the moment whilst he's hyperactive and woohoo out on that mad zone. But anyway, thank you very much for listening, and join me for the next episode. Goodbye.
It's Not a Rant, it's Articulate Warbling with Zach Ferguson. Written by Zach Ferguson, produced and edited by DB Spitzer, recorded at Badger's Drip Studios in glorious Portland, Oregon. Zach's part is, of course, recorded in Brighton, England. Want to help the show? Go to pgttcm.com. Check out what we've got. Go to Zach's shop in the show notes. Go to Zach's Instagram in the show notes. Find out how to help him out. And of course, Ashton Manor, Darkest Child by Kevin MacLeod. So, thank you so much, and join us next time.